Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week we have two really important guests on the question of criminal law, the University of Pittsburgh law professor David Harris and David Kennedy, a professor at the John Jay School of Criminal Justice in New York. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write in to us at politicswarroom.com. For next week's show, we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next at for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the link to our sponsor this week, Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting the sponsor. It helps make this podcast happen. James, I have covered or directed coverage of a number of different presidents with different policies, different people, and different priorities. One thing they shared: in times of emotional trauma, crisis, they sought to uplift or unify the country. Ronald Reagan after the Challenger space disaster, Bill Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing, George Bush after 9/11, Barack Obama at Mother Emanuel Church after 9 parishioners were killed. Donald Trump, by contrast, is trying to use the assassination of Republican influencer Charlie Kirk to divide us even more, to exacerbate bitterness, to make it worse. He and J.D. Vance and Stephen Miller are really stirring hate, revenge, and Trump went so far as to say, I could care less about unifying. They claim all the violence is perpetrated by left-wingers. Vance cited, who are those left-wingers? Vance said, the Ford Foundation and George Soros. Oh, sure. It's not neo-Nazis, it's not the Proud Boys, it's not the Oath Keepers, it's not the white nationalists, it's George Soros and Ford Foundation. That's just a lie. Charlie Kirk was killed not by a conspiracy of left-wingers, but by a lone gunman who apparently had adopted some left-wing views on issues like transgenders. By a lone gunman, not by a conspiracy. The man who killed the Minnesota former speaker, Michelle Bortman, was an anti-abortion Christian evangelical. Does Vance want to take away the tax exemption for all right-to-life groups or all evangelical churches? Of course not. Actually, more violence comes from the right, the white nationalists and so forth. People like Kathleen Ballou have really documented that. But Trump doesn't care about facts, obviously, or what it does to the country. He's in it only for his selfish sense. This is a disgrace, the reaction to the Charlie Kirk tragedy.
Well, these people are obvious and they are, but this is a little more insidious. Ross Douthat, who just can't come to grips with the fact that he belongs to a political party that's a cult, always has to count something else. This morning, he was talking about crime and how the left, I mean, violence and this kind of gunplay and how the left has to come to grips with itself. In the same day, I'm looking on this site, it says DLJ deletes study saying former domestic terrorism committed by the far right. We know where this is coming from. And they keep coming out and saying, what left-wing person is like Trump or J.D. Vance, anybody like that, calling for violence, telling them to be not son of a bitch Cole, or anything like that. These people have to come to grips is what they brought about. and they're going to try to change the subject every way that they can. And it's just a fact, okay? As short as there's left-wing violence, it is far less than right-wing inspired political violence. I'm sorry. It's a fucking fact. Well, get over it. It's a, you know, deal with the fact that you got a ignorant criminal in your political party that's president of the United States and quit making up shit.
You okay, James?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm so fine. Right.
James, we should tell our listeners, is in Munich. So I'm a little bit jealous of where he is, but the communication is coming through fine. You know, the other thing, every day you learn something about how they're even worse than you thought. Pam Bondi. I never have I heard an attorney general, and we've had some bad ones, display such remarkable ignorance. She has no idea what the First Amendment is. She said the other day, we're going to prosecute everybody who engages in hate speech. You know what, General? The First Amendment doesn't just protect good speech or nice speech. That's easy. Everyone agrees to that. It protects bad speech. It protects hate speech. It protects evil speech as long as it doesn't directly incite violence. We've known that for a long time. Apparently, it took Pam Bondi, you know, a little bit of a pushback from her stupid comment to understand that. That's because that Justice Department, with Pam Bondi, Todd Blanche, they got rid of the third guy. He got appointed to a court, and appeals court up in New Jersey, which is a disgrace. And Kash Patel disgraced himself at that out in Utah. He went out there trying to claim credit. He lied and he said, well, we've caught the guy. Well, we didn't. He had nothing to do with catching the guy. And then he came back and appeared before the Senate committee and all he wanted to do was insult them. We have, I think, the most unqualified and perhaps even corrupt Justice Department in the history of this country.
Yeah, we have corrupt, incompetent buffoons running the United States government. But let's talk about the dangers of cultural liberalism, whatever the fuck it is.
Yeah,
I mean, these people will do anything they can to talk around the subject. And the subject is we have a convicted felon for president who, in my opinion, is profiting off of the presidency. And many of the people, many is like an understatement, are idiots. Are ideological idiots. That's the problem the United States has. It's not some Berkeley town hall meeting or something.
Yeah, yeah. James, on another matter, the government funding bill is coming up now. I think Democrats are sort of playing it right, but I emphasize sort of. They can't get pushed into the corner saying it's the Democrats who are advocating a shutdown. They are not. They're saying, look, we're for funding the government if you do things that are very important to address the cost of living and problems that people are having. Keep the Obamacare subsidies, which are due to expire with this government during the duration of any long-term government funding. Do something about rural hospitals, which are getting clobbered by your bill. Maybe a little bit more on law enforcement, since what you're doing isn't working. And perhaps one or two, but a select group of things that address people's concerns. That's what they ought to be saying. I saw a column in the Times to say, said the Democrats can win a government shutdown. That's not the way you want to view it. You want to view it as that whether the Republicans are willing to make the kind of concessions that affect people's lives and particularly affect the awful cost of living problem.
So when you go into any negotiation and go into an event, you have to ask yourself, what is this the other side wants? I will tell you exactly what Donald Trump wants. He wants to shut the government down. Why does he want to shut the government down? Because he owns this economy. And everything that's happened, he's not so stupid that he doesn't know that it's not going very well, that the economy he inherited is better than the economy even after 9 months in office or whatever it is. And he feels like if he can get a government shutdown, he can blame the Democrats. And he can say that's the reason it's in a bad economy. I'm telling you, I promise you, that's exactly what's going on in his head. He thinks he needs, he may be right, by the way, some outside event where he can shift the blame, because there's no blame he can put on anybody. He's passed everything with all Republican votes. He hadn't got a single vote. and he's itching for this, and he wants to say that Hakeem Jeffers and Senator Schumer shut the government down. That's where you got to start when you start this whole process. And the Democrats, no one goes out and plants corn. They go out, they plow, they prepare the field, they plow it, they harrow it, they cultivate it, and then they do it. No pay to start supplying paint. You strip all the old paint, you go through all the prep stuff. We need to be, coming into this fight, we need to be in the prep stage. He is going to try to do whatever he can to shut it down so he can claim that 47 House Senate Democrats and 213 House Democrats are responsible for this. And he sees this as his only way out. So understand, they're not coming at this from a good faith position. And we want this, and you know, maybe we'll give you a little bit of that. We want the election, so we want 62% of what we got. No, they don't want this deal. They're looking at the shutdown as a lifeline. And they're probably going to do it.
Well, that's why it's absolutely imperative that the Democrats have a believable counter-narrative, which is not just we're for a shutdown. It is that, look, we're willing to fund the government, but we're not willing to fund the government if you're going to have 3.5 million people kicked off their health care and premiums go up. We're not willing to fund the government if you're going to let rural hospitals and one or two other, not a laundry list, not 17 issues. I think they can win that argument.
I do, too. In order to win the argument, you have to prepare the ground for it. You got to start laying out what the parameters of things you're going to be looking for. Extending subsidies to buy health insurance. I said 125,000 more costs, but I'm open to any of this. But you got to be out there talking about it now. You got to be preparing people for it. You don't want to pick up the paper September 28th and everybody goes, oh, God, here it goes. You know, well, one side says this, one side says that. Actually, one side wants to shut the government down, and that's Trump.
Yeah, I think that's true. Okay,
he just wants an excuse.
That's what the Trump presidency is all about. All right, we will be back with more on this one next week.
Get your fall fashion from Quince. The stuff is not just really affordable. It's really good. And my wife showed me, I guess most people realize I did. If your clothes get a little rumpled from traveling, if you just put them in the shower and turn it on hot, and the steam is better than paying $18 for the hotel laundry. But this stuff is good. It holds up. It's really inexpensive. It's stylish. It you know, spend your money on making deals, not the clothes you wear to make the deal.
You know, as we head into the cool of autumn, Quince is where you're going to turn for fall essentials that actually last. From cashmere to denim to boots, the quality at Quince consistently holds up, and the prices will still blow you away. Just picture the seasonal staples you'll wear nonstop and all the places you'll really be able to make a big entrance. If you haven't heard, all of Quince's pieces are defined by high-quality fabrics and classic fits. We love the super soft 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters, especially since they start at just $60. Add in their durable denim that actually fits right and real leather jackets that bring that clean, classic edge, and you just can't go wrong. You know, James, we could even get some motorcycles with those kind of outfits, although maybe we're too old for that.
Well, it's funny because I went to the BMW museum yesterday and I saw more motorcycles in one place I've seen in my life.
Best of all, there's no elevated price tag and everything we've seen from Quince has been nothing but solid. But you might be wondering, how do they do it? What makes Quince different? Well, it's actually pretty simple. They partner directly with ethical factories and skip the middleman. So you get top-tier fabrics and craftsmanship at half the price of similar brands. And, you know, as soon as you see their stuff, you're going to be blown away. And it gets even better. The second you try your new clothes on, you'll see that the fits are perfect. The fabrics are incredible. The style unmatched. You can firmly see that everyone needs Quince's extra fine Australian merino polo. There's nothing better for looking great, and there's so much more. James and I, you know, fashion plates that we are looking into some new activewear now that the nights are getting colder, and Quince has us covered. You know, as good as you might look in your new gear, my Quince favorite is their luxurious stretch wool dress pant. They feel amazing. They're perfect for getting things done on the hill or just reading in a recliner in style. Don't wait. Keep it classic and cool this fall with long-lasting staples from Quince. Go to quince.com/warroom for free shipping on your order and 365-day return. That's Quince, Quince.com/warroom. Free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/warroom. The link is also in our show notes. The Trump administration is trying to make crime a major issue. They've sent federal forces into Washington, D.C., now Memphis, and promised to do it elsewhere, which they say is necessary because of a rampant crime. We have two of the most knowledgeable and prolific experts on crime in America today. David Harris, professor of criminal law at the University of Pittsburgh, and a previous guest, and David Kennedy, a criminologist at the John Jay School of Criminal Justice in New York. Both have worked on crime issues and done prodigious research in cities across America. I want to start to both of you. President Trump, as I said, is sending federal forces in. He said, look, it's reducing crime. I can go out for dinner, and Washington, D.C. is much safer, and we're going to do this to other cities now. Is this an effective plan to reduce crime in America? Let me start with you, David Harris, and then we'll turn to David Kennedy.
No, Al, I don't think it is. These are performances as much as they are anything else, in which the president is trying to show that he's the toughest police chief in the country. The job of policing American cities and towns is explicitly the job of our police departments and our local officials. We've seen how different officials in states of California and Illinois have said, we don't need you here. What we need is people who understand the things we are already doing that has put crime at an historically low point, and we need you to bolster us there. What about money for violence interruption programs like the ones run by David Kennedy? Those things are very effective. We have a lot of data that shows how effective they are, yet you are cutting that source of revenue to support those programs. So this isn't about fighting crime. This is about showing something to the president's supporters who are already convinced of what he's doing.
David Kennedy?
So, as always with my good friend David Harris, what he said to begin with, and then, you know, I am speaking to you from Brooklyn, New York. And New York City, including Brooklyn, is one of the historic crime control success stories. People forget this when I teach about what's happened in New York to younger people. I have to try to explain to them what it used to be like here because they can't believe it. But in the early 1990s, this was a city that had over 2,200 homicides a year. And the city is now down to something right around 300 homicides a year out of a city of more than 8 million people. It's an extraordinary success story. And we can draw a comparison to what's going on with the administration and to what happened in New York. So one stretch of that long decline in New York City was the era of stop, question, and frisk. And the philosophy of the leadership in the city and the NYPD at the time was to flood neighborhoods with NYPD officers, stop as many people as they could manage. What we know about that is the period of greatest crime decline was before stop, question, and frisk. The crime decline was not particularly great during that era. it has accelerated on the far side of stop, question, and frisk. The city is doing better now than it was then. And the explicit philosophy that has both produced these huge public safety gains in the modern era and dramatically reduced unpleasant contact between NYPD and the citizens of New York is what NYPD calls precision policing. And it is the core fact that my friend David knows, that I know, that everybody doing effective crime prevention work now knows, is that the enormous public safety issues that this country face, and the one thing that I will give the administration credit for, is saying what we are doing now is not good enough. To say crime is down is often taken as saying it's okay. And no hospital director would ever say, we're losing fewer patients this year than we were last year, so things are fine. Right? Doctors determine always to do better. But the work that has consistently made sustainable gains in public safety in this country is the recognition that these very serious problems are driven by very small numbers of exceptional and identifiable people. And NYPD proved that occupying neighborhoods is neither effective, nor is it sustainable, nor does the public see it as legitimate. And effective, sustainable, and legitimate is what we should be aiming for.
Well, explain how you do that. Explain, you don't occupy the neighborhoods, but there are certain neighborhoods where most crime is centered, I believe both of you have found. So what do you do? You don't occupy. Let me ask David Kennedy first, then I'm going to turn to David Harris.
So it's true that certain neighborhoods are what we have always called, quote, high crime, unquote, or dangerous, or words to that effect. That's also, as it turns out, dramatically misleading. So we have a saying in my organization at John Jay, the National Network for Safe Communities, there is no such thing as a dangerous neighborhood. And what we mean by that is that communities that are seen as, quote, high crime, unquote, that crime is real and it's very serious and it has ripple effects through entire communities. It's driven by a fantastically small number of identifiable people. So the math in the United States, which has now been proved over decades of city research, big city, small city, north, south, east coast, west coast, doesn't matter. If you look at homicides and non-fatal shootings, half or more of them are demonstrably connected with a very special population that in totality will make up around 0.5% of the city's population. And those are mostly groups, not individuals. They're drug crews, they're what people call gangs, they're little neighborhood sets, they're intergenerational problem families. But what really drives what people now call community violence is cyclical, retaliatory, vendetta-like violence amongst very, very small numbers of people. And it was wonderful talking about this kind of thing during the pandemic because suddenly everybody was an epidemiologist. And we were able to say to people, look, violence prevention is contact tracing. If you see a homicide, if you see a non-fatal shooting, if you look at the people involved in that incident, and then if you do that over and over again across many incidents, that simple process of looking at what is actually going on and who is involved leads directly to this small world of very active people. And once you know who they are and what they're doing, there are all kinds of ways to intervene. But that basic fact, it's a small number of people, they're very active. None of this is, you know, undercover or underground. It's all literally happening in public. at least on the most serious violence, we have pretty good records. We have a pretty fair idea about what's going on. And that leads you directly to what David and my colleague, Andrew Papakristos, a sociologist of this kind of thing at Northwestern University, what Andy calls the small world of murder. And it's recognizing this small world on which everything else that has transformed violence prevention has been built.
David Harris, I want you to pick up on all this, if you will. And what we're talking about more effective and smarter policing, surely. Are we also talking about more policing in certain areas?
Yeah, it can be described as, I think I've heard David use the phrase, focused deterrence, because what you're doing is you're focusing on this very small group of people. For these few people in any neighborhood or city concentrated in one area, any one of them could end up on either side of that gun as a victim or as a shooter. And so it isn't so much more policing, it's better and smarter and focused policing. That's why NYPD calls it precision policing. So if you focus on the right people and you figure out what they're doing, where they are, and how to use leverage against them to stop this, whether that means a prison sentence or something else, you can get a handle on this. That's the true tragedy of what's going on right now, because we know what works. The same kind of thing is happening here in my hometown of Pittsburgh. We have a violence prevention program. It's brought homicides to their lowest number in, I think, 8 years. Non-fatal gunshot wounds going down. All kinds of good things happening. We know that this is out there and can happen. It can happen at the community level. And when you involve community actors, not just police, you get amazing returns, because they're the people who know the ground, who know the folks involved, who have the ability to do that kind of intervention in that cyclical retaliation. So we know the recipe. What we don't need is people to come in here with troops, with the National Guard, because that doesn't help. It may even make things worse.
David, you mentioned, I think, and I want you both to feel free to jump in at any time. I think you mentioned earlier that so-called big, beautiful bill actually cut some important criminal justice. Would you elaborate on that and what effect that had?
Yes. The effect isn't fully settled in yet, but we know that a lot of federal money was being used for violence prevention. And these violence prevention programs can be very different in different places, but they usually focus on bolstering community efforts, people-based efforts to interrupt that cycle of violence, whether it's violence interrupters, whether it's people who are analyzing data on this so we know who those actors are, or even whether it's bolstering police departments. All of this comes out of all the research that David Kennedy and other people have done over the years to show us the way. We know what's out there. We know what works. And that's the kind of money that was cut in the Big Beautiful Bill, so-called. You can't even estimate the damage this is going to do to our ongoing efforts to make our cities more livable and less dangerous. It is going to impact those efforts, because without the funding, some of these groups won't be able to go forward. And, you know, you put 10 groups, neighborhood groups on the street doing this work, you will get a decrease in violence and violent crime. And so cutting those kinds of funds is just the worst thing you could do. If your goal is to have a good place to live and a good place to work for everyone.
Worst thing you could do, David Kennedy?
Well, if it's not the worst, it's close enough. Yeah. So look, cops love this stuff. And, you know, it may sound like, you know, it's not strong steel backbone kind of thing. But I've been doing this kind of work for 40 years now. And when I was first welcomed into this world, I've spent half my life with cops. From the very beginning, they said, we can't arrest our way out of this. They know that.
Amen.
They want this kind of help. The cuts that David's talking about have come not just on the backs of community organizations. A lot of it is being taken away from police departments and away from law enforcement. It's goring everybody's ox. And, you know, a lot of this is couched as kind of a tug of war between right and left. It really isn't. So the right has very traditionally said, good decisions matter. Bad decisions should have consequences. Accountability matters. Rules matter. Laws matter. The left has typically said root causes matter. The damage that we've done to especially communities of color needs to be understood and addressed. Communities and families need good schools and good health care and economic opportunity and safe transportation. And part of what these new approaches recognize is sort of two fundamental things. Everybody's right, right? All of those things matter. And the second is that we've been trying forever to fix those things at the system and community level. We've tried to do police reform. We've tried to get sentencing right. We've tried to undo getting sentencing wrong. We've tried to do economic development. And that is God's work, all of it. But it hasn't produced the results at the city level, at the community level that we want. And if you look at what this kind of new portfolio of evidence-based violence prevention does, it gets things right or close to right on those things for this small world of very special people. Like, I don't know how to create accountability for every crime everybody commits in David's city. But we absolutely know how to produce accountability for a handful of neighborhood crews that are at high risk of killing people. That's something we can do. And when they understand that, you know, the argument on the right is if the stove's hot, people aren't going to touch it. And guess right, they're right. If we get this right and transparent and predictable, that matters. But so at the same time does recognizing that some of those guys are going out to the corner because their mom can't pay the mortgage or turn the light bill on and their little brothers are hungry. We can fix those things for very special people in very special circumstances. And then things get predictably better, as David says.
David Kennedy, people associate, I think, a lot of crime with drugs. And you have written, I believe, that it's not so much the drugs, it's the street scene. Explain that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, as it turns out. And I'll be obnoxious for a minute before I get more serious. I am in North Brooklyn as I speak with you, and I can walk out of my front door and across the Brooklyn Bridge and into Lower Manhattan with all those tall buildings. And I guarantee you that those tall buildings are full of drugs. There is cocaine, there is Adderall and study drugs, there is ketamine, there's probably a little bit of heroin. If drugs alone caused violence, Wall Street would be running red with blood. and it's not. So the larger point here, I think, is that We've believed for a long time that what people are now calling community violence, like high levels of neighborhood violence, are driven by money. And it's a perfectly coherent story, right? If there's a vigorous street drug trade and somebody has a bad drug debt or they get ripped off or something, you can't call 911, you can't go to the Better Business Bureau, you have to defend your interest with firearms, and there we are. And that perfectly plausible story just turns out not to be true. And again, when you go to the violence and you look at, as we do in our problem analysis work for any new city, you go back and look at years of homicides and non-fatal shootings and say about each one, what happened here? Overwhelmingly, what happens is running disputes of different kinds. So this is what cops call beef. It's what in other settings we would call vendetta. And what you see on the ground is that a group will be feuding with another group. That's been going on literally for decades. None of the people in either group right now know what it was about. They just know that they've got ops, what the street call opposition. And they know who their friends are and they know who their enemies are. And the beef can start over anything. You know, it might start over a drug issue, but it's just as likely to start over a rumor or a boy-girl issue or some little social slight that the rest of us would let go. But what we're talking about is overwhelmingly a group of young men issue. And we really shouldn't be surprised that when you get groups of young men and they're traumatized by extraordinarily high levels of violence that they've experienced, their friends have been killed, their friends have been hurt, they have people who try to hurt them, they're living extraordinarily disorderly lives. We shouldn't, and they're armed because business requires being armed and they think that self-defense requires being armed. We shouldn't be surprised that in that setting, small things turn into big things and big things get continued. And when I talk about this in public, you know, in a mixed setting with half the people in the room, women, I love this because I will say to the women in the room, look, you know this. You have been living with this your entire life. You know that there is no stupider organism on the planet than an adolescent male with his friends watching. And that's what's really going on here. And we read all kinds of fancy motives into it when it's very simple. It's actually very common sense. And it's honor culture stuff. And honor culture is we are very familiar with in all kinds of settings.
So I know that people are trying this, that you have this honor culture, this sort of cycle of violence where A shoots B and because C is B's brother, he's going to end up trying to shoot A. And through technology, people claim that we can get to A to break that cycle of violence. Is there any validity to that? Is that being used anywhere to your knowledge, Professor Harris?
James, there are ways to break that cycle. I'm not sure about the technological ways to do it.
Right.
But the human ways to do it definitely exist, and there's good data to show that they work. For instance, you have a person, you have an organization that is designed to interrupt this cycle of violence by responding even while the victim in the first shooting is in the hospital. We have that going on here. People go in, they talk to them, they make arrangements perhaps to get the family moved away. They want to stop that cycle of retaliation. And the people who do this work are often folks who know the street. They understand relationships. They've been there. They're not people in police uniforms. They're people who understand what's going on intuitively and through experience. And that is a possible way to interrupt the violence and to interrupt the cycle. If we can do that, we can keep this to one bad incident and not have it cycle on endlessly. It's really difficult work, and it can be very dangerous work for the interrupters. But it is so worth doing and so worth pushing forward with. It does work.
So, Professor Kennedy, when we had Professor Harris on some years ago, we asked him, where are people doing this successfully? As I recall, Camden, New Jersey was a place that actually had kind of broken the cycle a little bit more than other people. In your mind, what policies of what local governments are doing a better job than others? In other words, I'm just elected mayor of New Orleans. What place do I want to go and study what they're doing?
Walk outside.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. It was pretty good.
New York is at the forefront of this. That people think New York is... I have a number of ways to finish that sentence, and I'm editing myself. They think that New York is really dangerous. New York is one of the safest cities in the United States. It used to be the case that every European city was safer than any American city. That's not true anymore. When you look at Europe, which remains very, very, very safe, New York City is now in the middle or the lower part of the list of European cities with respect to its rates of violence and serious crime. James, the really good news is that, you know, 10 years ago, I would have had an answer to that question because there would have been a relatively small number of places in the U.S. that were doing this kind of thing. And they stood out partly because they were effective, but also because they were exceptional. This stuff isn't exceptional anymore. It's everywhere. And as we've all been following the public debate about crime in the last couple of weeks, there's a list of cities that keeps coming up as an argument that crime is down and the kind of extreme measures we're talking about are not going to be helpful. And just to say it again, crime is down. Crime is not down enough. Right? We really need to get up every day and figure out how to do better. And simply saying things are better is not the same as saying this is not an issue, particularly for the communities where violence is concentrated. It's a very serious issue. But it's also true that we're talking about Philadelphia. We're talking about Baltimore. We're talking about Oakland, California. We're talking about New York City. We're talking about Detroit. All of those cities are doing the work that David and I are talking about. It is part of the reason that they are doing so much better. And Oakland's a really fascinating case study in this. They have done this work. They have done it very effectively. They saw massive reductions across the city in both violence and arrests. They switched course. They went a different direction in terms of Oakland's public safety policy. The violence came back. They brought in a new director in the Department of Violence Prevention in Oakland who knows what she's doing and put her foot down and said, we are going back to what we know works, put it back in place, and within a year, things had plummeted again. If you know what to look for across the country, this is almost like turning a thermostat up and down. It is just that predictable. And lots and lots and lots of places have learned this lesson and they're making it work.
Professor Harris, you have anything you want to add to that?
I think David is exactly right. I mean, there are many places you can see this. They don't all do it the same because they're not the same place. Here in Pittsburgh, you might say we're doing it on a public health model. But the violence prevention work has become internalized to people who are serious about public safety. And I mean serious in the sense that they want to do the things that work. They don't want to just do the things that look like they work or feel like they work. They want to do the things that work. David is 100% right that we need to do more because every person who is lost to crime and violence, whether their lives are cut short or they're badly injured, I mean, all you have to do is think of how would your mother react to that if it was somebody in your family. And you know that it's not enough yet, but we do know what can help. And shame on us and on our government leaders at every level if we don't pursue what we do know works. That's the basic mission of public policy. We've got a problem. Let's identify it. Let's figure out what works. Oh, okay, we know. Let's do more of that. And instead, we're getting performances of military invasions. This is not helpful. At best, it's not helpful.
And And I'm close enough to this that I realize I forgot to say it out loud, and I should do that. The political divisions on this all but go away at the local level. The arguments between right and left that dominate our public discourse and our politics, you know, David is exactly right that in nearly every city, there are people who care deeply about this. Some of them are elected and appointed to care deeply about it. Some of them are called to it. But those people want to make things better. And at the level of local police chiefs and local prosecutors and, you know, the career assistant U.S. attorneys in the federal prosecutor's offices, local corrections, local nonprofits, local service providers, local community violence practitioners. This is not a right and left argument there. This is, to David's point, we've now got a pretty good idea of what works, and let's do it. And in the better quarters, there's also a real humility. It is one of the greatest accomplishments in public policy over the last couple of decades that we can now say we know how to make this work. That did not used to be true. But it's also young, it's embryonic. None of it is mature. None of it can't be made better. And this is a field that is absolutely determined to build on this foundation and make it even more effective.
So before I turn it back down real quick, it seems that you both of you, by the definition, top-tier criminologists, I guess, for lack of a better word, maybe like a better another word. If I put the top 15 criminologists in a row, would anybody dispute this? Is there somebody say, hey, no, but on the other hand, you know, but there's another way to do this? Or what y'all talking about consensus policy in people who study this?
My brief answer would be there'd be a strong consensus. I mean, David knows, just like I do, that any room full of academics, you're going to have arguments.
Yeah, I see.
Right? I think it is a pretty strong consensus. David, do you agree?
I think that may be a little bit generous to our colleagues. but there absolutely is a consensus. It's not entire, but it's getting there. There absolutely is a consensus on the empirical basis on which all of this work has been built, that very small numbers of people and very small numbers of very small locations drive violent crime. The catchword in the business is hot people and hot places. And that's just science at this point. Nobody argues with that anymore. And I think, James, more important in practical terms, when you get frontline practitioners together, so again, the people who are elected and appointed to do this work and have actual responsibility for it, there really now is something very close to a consensus about this.
You know, we've been doing this program for, I guess, 7 years. I'm not sure we've ever added as much value as we have in this conversation or learned as much or our listeners learned as much. Let me just try two quick questions before we go. David Harris, if you could do three things, you'd ask the federal government, knowing this is a local issue, but we would restore the funds, I assume, for evidence-based violence prevention. Are there a couple other things that governments at each level could do?
Of course, we would restore those funds and build on them if we can. But it isn't all about money. It's about finding the people who are determined to do that work and elevating them. And those people can be in community groups. They can be in police departments. They can be elected officials. Because there are always people who are understanding this more and more and who can get the job done for us and with us. We should also remember that this is, you know, as David said much earlier, you can't arrest your way out of this. You cannot tough your way out of this. You cannot military your way out of this. This has to be handled in the ways that we have seen grow up organically. And that's what I would do. I'd put the spotlight on that. I'd tell those stories night and day. I would back them up. I would find the people in my communities who want to do that work and know how to do it. And I would push ahead with them.
David Kennedy, I hear from some friends in New York, they're highly, they praise the police chief, Jessica Tisch, a great deal. As you pointed out, crime has been coming down. It's been a success story in New York for many, many years, well before Commissioner Tisch got there. But how important is it the next mayor retain that police chief and the things we're talking about?
I am going to decline to answer that question. What I am going to say, because it's a little overly specific. What's really important is that whoever's in that job recognize how important it is for the police department to take responsibility for producing outcomes on the ground. That's a relatively new thing in policing, even in New York City. Until Bill Bratton came in to be, his first stint as commissioner in NYPD, NYPD took no responsibility for addressing violence. It explicitly felt like it responded, it did not prevent. And those days in policing should be gone. And mostly across the country, they are. So whoever's in that job should have that absolute entrepreneurial commitment to results on the ground. It should recognize the importance of what in the field we call legitimacy, that police and policing should be seen by the affected community as honest, transparent, principled, and in the interest of the community. And it should remind NYPD, and probably more than that, should remind the rest of city government, which can have a tendency to forget this, that it is a very small number of people in a very small number of places that are at the heart of all of this. I think there's real room to be gained in even better relationships between the police and community violence prevention, even in New York City. What New York City calls the crisis management system could be better integrated with NYPD and vice versa. So I don't have any reason to think that anybody who would get that job as mayor would not agree with everything I just said. I think that's just conventional wisdom at this point.
Well, that's good news. Listen, it has been great news to have you both on. As I say, I don't think we've ever learned more, which I think says something good about you, maybe something limited about us. But I really mean that, though. Being serious, I just think this has been a great discussion with two of the real experts on this. And I think you have really shattered some of the myths that we hear coming out of Washington these days, and also enumerated some of the successes that we're seeing around the country. And as you said, David Kennedy, we have to do more. So I thank you both for being with us, and we hope you'll come back at some point.
I apologize. I'm in Munich. No appeasement on violent crime. Yeah. I actually saw the building that Chamberlain came out of.
Amen to that, James. No appeasement. All right.
Thank you, guys.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
So right. Those guys were really good, weren't they?
They were fabulous. They laid out a whole
agenda. God, they were good.
But I mean, the important thing is there's consensus on this. They're really not arguing that much. I kind of thought they would be kind of pissy with each other, but that wasn't the case at all.
No, and I think the one thing is that they both made a good point. It's not enough for Democrats to say crime is coming down. It is. They ought to say crime's coming down. Here's why, and we have to do more, and we can't let the Trump administration cut programs that work. I just worry when I think both of these guys made that point. To simply say crime is coming down is insufficient.
In places, it's coming down. Let's see what's working and what's not working.
Right.
Because there's a lot that's not working that we could work better. I agree, but I'm a little bit more that there are people that are being very successful at this. Let's study what they're doing and try to replicate it.
And
I would start with just in a little more positive direction. But that's
I think much of this success was enumerated. The reasons was enumerated by the two Davids today. I think they really did lay it out there. Now for the outrage of the week. Trump has sued the New York Times for $15 billion for allegedly defaming him. This is a fatuous, ridiculous suit. No chance of winning. Disney, ABC, and CBS Paramount, to their discredit, paid off Trump when he sued them. But that wasn't because of the journalism. That was because of their business interest. And they caved and was really outrageous. I think that this is the first president, by the way. He did those suits before he was president. But in suing the Times and the Wall Street Journal, this is the first president to ever sue news organizations while he was president. He sued the Journal for $10 billion for publishing a story about the lewd birthday message he sent to sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. He said that was totally false, except turned out to be totally true. Now he's suing the New York Times, which he says is out to get him. That is equally ridiculous. He has no, even though he's brought the suit before a friendly judge in Florida, he has no chance of winning this suit. What he hopes to do is just inflame that further narrative among the MAGA base. The press is all evil, the enemy of the people. And he's going to try to intimidate, not so much the Times, that won't work, but try to intimidate other news organizations that, hey, they have less deep pockets and I'll go after you too. And ultimately, he and his right-wing allies want to overturn the Sullivan case, which protects press rights. So he's an authoritarian with no regard for the Constitution, including the First Amendment. And the only recourse is to fight back as you do with any bully. The New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and others, Ann Selzer in Iowa, will fight back and they will win. I worry about his ability to bully and intimidate others, but the stakes are clear. A free press is synonymous with a free country.
Well, I'm in Munich right now. And I think about this country and I think about our country. And I got to tell you, we're not looking too good. So concurrent with my visit to Dachau, had a superb German government certified tour guide. Everything that the Germans do not deny their history. And then I pick up going on site and they're trying to not show the photograph of the slave that was beaten, his back was just scarred with nothing. And they want to know why we don't teach the good part to slavery. Okay, we both have a horrendous crime in the German background, American background. I'm not going to get, you know, the Holocaust was unspeakable. But you know what they don't do? They don't deny it. It's there. It's preserved. There's no admission. You go over here, you don't, when you go to Dachau, you don't pay, you don't do anything, you walk right in there. You have to, it has to be like a certified guide. It's not no bullshit person going and take you through there. And, you know, I saw the same thing when I went to Berlin. And the whole idea that you can erase history or you can glorify something as staggeringly horrific as we had in our country and if anything, more horrific than they had in their country. But what they do is we what they do almost universally. Now you got this, these clowns coming up. You always got to watch that. But I got to tell you, I'm impressed at the way that this place deals with its history. It doesn't deny it at all. But you don't have to see no statues to him or Goring around here either.
Yeah, no, I am too. We every time I've been there, I've been impressed. This is a difficult time, James.
You look at what's going on in the Congress. You look at the amount of corruption we're looking at. By the way, you know something we forget: the amount of debt that we accumulate. And it's just one little statistic today. Della Volpe had a piece about young males, which I'm very big on. Do you know what the average first-time male home buyer's age is today? 38.
Well.
I don't want to get into the Charlie Kirk thing. I'll talk about it next week.
I'm trying to think. How old were you when you bought your first home?
Well, I was older because I wasn't married. Okay, I'm a little bit of a different case.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
But
well,
most,
that we can agree on.
Yeah. Most people buy a house. When I grew up, bought houses in the mid-20s to early 30s. I mean, you got into cycle, and of course you buy a house, and it would appreciate, and you'd move. But 38 years old. The first house. Yeah. John makes another point that's really important. The Republicans, they meet these people where they are. You know, we meet them on TV spots and websites. And it was a good piece. I think anybody should read, and Democratic strategists should read what he said.
I get it.
We ain't connected with these people.
I get it, because he is good. Okay, we're going now, James, to one of our favorite segments, our listener questions. Boy, do we have some smart, insightful listeners. Carrie in San Diego, California. This is picking up on one of the things we discussed. She said, given Trump's dismal approval on almost every issue, is it possible he could try to use the government shutdown as an excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act?
Of course it is. What is, my dear friend San Diego, what do you think he wouldn't do? If it's not to invoke the Insurrection Act, which he would love to do, it's to make an excuse for the fact that his economic policies are frankly catastrophic, to make excuse for the fact that the whole world is making a workaround on the United States, to make excuses for the fact that soybean farmers in North Dakota are having to burn their crops because of his idiotic policies. So you're exactly right, and I'll give you one further piece of advice. I wouldn't put anything past this guy. Yeah, I said the word anything. You got it. Underline it.
Right. Good point. The next is from Sam Tolles in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Sam is the nephew of the former Washington Post cartoonist Tom Tolles, who kindly sent his best to Judy and me. Tom, I have to tell you, the Washington Post still does some good journalism, but you are really missed, and that editorial page has been decimated. What used to be one of the most interesting editorial pages in the country, is barely worth reading these days. And Tom Tolles, you and Herblock were legends here, and we miss you. Anyway, your nephew Sam, be sure and say hi to Tom, says Democrats are terrible at social media. He thinks that Mondami and AOC are winning based less on their popular policy than they understand the new media ecosystem, while national Democrats are still stuck in the press release package meeting era. I think, Sam, you have a point. I'm not going to pretend that I really understand the new media ecosystem, because I don't. But I think there are some Republicans who have gotten that more quickly than some older Democrats have. And I think your examples, AOC is a genius at that. And I'm encouraged, for instance, that Andy Beshear, consultant, is a former communications chief for AOC, a wonderful woman named Lauren Hitt. So maybe Democrats are starting to learn, James, but I think Sam's point is absolutely right.
So all of these things that come up, you know, think how much communication changes, the printing press, the radio, television, the internet, the anything, social media. And it's two things. How do you communicate it and what do you communicate?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you go back to, what's that, Marshall McLuhan or something, the medium is the message. Sometimes what you communicate on says a lot about what you're communicating. And it's never bit my hand, but I'm convinced by this listener's question. I'm convinced by what Della Volpe said in the Times. I'm convinced by what I'm seeing is I don't think we're doing a good job of meeting these people, particularly these younger people, where they are.
Now,
one thing I will say is all of these things do better with extreme ideologues. You know, no one wants to go in website and you know, see what Senator Sheldon Whitehouse said or Michael Bennett. All right, they're never going to get the truth. But maybe the best senators we've had in this century. But no matter what they do or try to do, they're not going to get the same kind of shit that a Rand Paul's going to get you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene. You understand you're going into this, but sanity is a limitation.
Matthew, in Boston, Massachusetts, still maybe my favorite city, one of my three favorites, says that you have mentioned, James, he said, casually breezed past the idea that Mississippi could be a competitive Senate race in 2026. He wants to know what's going on there, and please elaborate.
Thank you. Okay, so the black population of Mississippi is a little bit north of 38.5.
Black population or voting population?
Black share. So for every 100 Mississippians, about 38.5. Black, which is the highest of any state in the country. There is a core of about 21%, I'd have to revise it and talk to a couple of people, but it's pretty close, of whites that vote Democratic. So the way you did this on your cell phone, if we can get 21% of, so let's say it comes in and the black share is 31. Okay, well, 92% of 31, and then 21 of 69 will get you one result. However, 92 of 35 and 21 of 65 is going to produce an entirely different number. And what the Democrats have done in Mississippi is we would say, let's now, and this is true throughout the South, let's nominate the most moderate white we can, and we'll get, maybe we can get out 21 to 22, but whatever happens is we get stuck at a 31.5 or 32 share when it should be higher. Our candidate is a gentleman by the name of Scott Collum. He's a black DA prosecutor who gets elected in a majority white county. He's got appeal, and if he can get that black share up to 34 plus, I think he's in range, but it's kind of your cell phone math. You can do it and figure it out where we got to be. And I think we have a better chance of getting there than most people. If you remember, Albert, you remember very well, Brandon lost about 2 points maybe.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
know, Mississippi is just much better opportunity than Louisiana or Alabama for that, or Arkansas, which is none. I think Mississippi.
Or Tennessee.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we tend to just lump. That's the problem with, I call it the doctrine of lumping. You just lump everything together. That's why, of course, I get on this tangent all the time. I hate the phrase people of color, communities of color, because it just lumps everybody that's not white. It's just some arrogant shit saying they all say. It's just lumping. I don't like lumping.
James, Mark in New Hampshire, those people in New Hampshire are always thinking about presidential politics. That's the cottage industry there. Mark says, can you comment on a possible Beshear Moore presidential ticket? I vowed that I wasn't going to talk about 2028 until we finish 2026. There's a season for everything. And the season now is the midterms, the most important midterms, I believe, in my lifetime. And so I don't really know, but I will tell you I'll break my vow. That would be a very attractive ticket either way. Andy Beshear and Wes Moore, and it just underscores that talent that is out there. And, you know, let's get through the midterms. Let's win the House, maybe the Senate, and then let's showcase some of this great talent.
Absolutely. And I don't, and I, you and I are on this. In Dale playing, that is a great combination. Boy, would I be enthusiastic about it. But you know, you could come up with 10, maybe 12, 14 other combinations that would be impressive too. When you got a big field that's very talented, you can see a lot of things falling your way.
Right.
And, you know, usually when the president, whoever wins the nomination for president, that always happened. Very often they pick somebody who's, in, you know, had run for president before Biden picking, I mean, Obama picking Biden, President Clinton picking Al Gore. It really helps to have somebody that's been on the turf of a national campaign before. So we're going to have, you know, we're going to get a lot of experience in the Democratic primaries. And yeah, I'm so with you. Even for a lifelong Democrat, this is going to be hard for us to screw up. Although we could.
Managed to do it in 2024, that's for sure.
Sure did.
By the way, I would quickly say, of all the things I am not interested in, it is Joe Biden and Kamala Harris relitigating the 2024 election. We know Joe Biden never should have run again. He I think, really, you know, really hurt badly his legacy. It was stupid. It was selfish. And Kamala Harris was a mediocre candidate. Period. End of story. Let's move on.
Yeah, but the story has to be taken a little bit further, because this program, I'll say, was consistent early and often that Biden should not run an election.
Right.
Not very few people, you know, rode that horse with us. And so after it happens and it's now apparent to everybody, then Harris says, well, it kind of wasn't my place to say something, but I don't think he should have run. Now the guy has done himself in with me. I don't want to hear about him anymore. It's Pete Buttigieg. Because now Pete Buttigieg is saying, well, I don't think he should have run. Well, goddamn, man, say something when it can help. What right. good does it do to say it after the whole thing? Oh, I wasn't in a position to say that. Yeah, you were. You're in a better position than two podcast junkies sitting there talking about how bad this is.
You're right on Buttigieg. Absolutely. On this issue alone, I give Harris a little bit of a pass. Pretty hard when you're the sitting vice president and the beneficiary to publicly call on him not to run. But Buttigieg does not have that excuse.
If the country, and we know this, and she knows it, the entire American experiment, the whole thing was at stake, okay? You could have started, you could have, like, built coalitions in the White House. You could have talked to people and say, look, you need to talk to Joe. I'm in a bit of a difficult position here, but this is not where it is. I don't give anybody a pass, because the price of silence is so manifestly horrible. I'd say you got an excuse. I'm not that generous.
The price of silence was Donald Trump.
I'm not that generous. The price
of silence was Donald Trump.
Right.
That's what they ought to understand.
It might have been uncomfortable and a lot of things, but there ain't nothing more uncomfortable than this shit.
Paula in Sacramento, California, says she thinks it's tasteless to call for gun control right now, given an assassination. But is it a more valid issue than ever down the road? Should it be a major part of any upcoming Democratic effort?
You know, of course, nobody would be more for some kind of, you know, restrictions. Remember, we did away with assault ban weapons from 1994 to 2004. I like to remind people. It enjoys public support, but it's going to go nowhere. And hopefully we get a Democratic president who can lay the grounds, and maybe we can do something like an assault weapons ban. And maybe we can, you know, put there are other same things that we can do, but I don't know that call it that Charlie Kirk's assassination, a murder, what do you want to call it? And, you know, maybe you want to wait another 3 or 4 days. I'll wait another week before I tell people what I really think, but sometimes you got to, situations like this, you got to let things digest. But don't worry, I'll have Ross Stewart, Brett Stevens, and David Brooks. Why I can't be a liberal? Okay, good. Stupid shit.
John in Arizona. John, next time tell us where in Arizona. It's a big, really interesting state. John says, can the Supreme Court be counted on to preserve democracy? So far, they seem to be allowing Trump to win every case. John, I fear the simple answer is no. I'm not as hard on John Roberts. I'm not quite as hard on John Roberts as James is. But I think two things. Number one, and I think both suggest he's really kind of a coward. He does not want to be in a 5-4 minority in decisions. And even more, if he can get a 5-4 majority, I think he's afraid that Trump will disobey whatever court edict is handed down. And he doesn't have the slightest idea what he would do then. And so, therefore, I think the Supreme Court, with its natural Republican proclivities, can't be counted on to stand up to Trump to preserve democracy.
Well, John Roberts don't think he's any better than the rest of them. I don't see any evidence of it, particularly since, you know, 2016 election. I think they look at what is going to allow the Republicans to win most election, what's going to allow the people that we like to make the most money. And I don't think John Roberts gives one whit's ass about democracy, anything like that. All he cares about is Republicans winning an election and all his friends making money. That's my view.
Yeah. Our last question, I'm going to violate our rules here because it comes from Jono, J-O-N-O. Jono, I have no idea where you're from, what state, what town. This is the last time I'm going to ask a Jono question without you telling us where you're from, because that's really, I think, we find that really important and interesting. But Jono asks, if Tim Miller and the Bulwark can get behind Mondami, why can't you, James?
I don't know that I'm against him. I vote for him.
Yeah.
Fine. And a lot of other people are. But do I think that his brand of things that he said are consistent with a national democratic message that I would prefer? No, but I'm in a coalition, so I don't get everything I want. But I think the guy's honest. I think he's articulate. I think he sees that the real problem people have is struggling to make ends meet. So, yeah, I give him credit and I would vote for him. I don't know if anybody really cares what I do because I don't live in New York. But to answer your question, yeah.
Yeah, I said in the primary that I reluctantly would prefer Cuomo because I was afraid the Republicans would make a big issue out of Mondami. I've changed my mind totally. I think I was wrong. I think Cuomo is a spent force. He's kind of making more of a fool of himself. And I frankly think at this stage, Mondami would be a better mayor. Among other things, a lot of the things he proposes to do aren't realistic. And if he can lift the spirits of New Yorkers, some who need their spirits lifted, that would be a good thing.
Remember, there are twice as many more than that. More people in New Jersey and Virginia than there are in New York City.
Far more. All right, listen, keep those questions coming. They are great questions. If we didn't get to them this week, we'll try to get to it next week, but tell us where you're from. Channeling you, Jono. So thank you very much, and we love this segment. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Quince, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review because we're going to be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.